listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When you look at our country's recent history, it can seem like we have been careening from one catastrophe to the next. Endless wars, financial collapse, and widespread institutional failures. But the problem, according to MSNBC host Chris Hayes, isn't just the people in charge. It's the mythology of how we select them, meritocracy. His book is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our program today. Hello.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You call the era we live in the Great Disillusionment or the Fall Decade. What do you see as the many lowlights of the last 12 years?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been through a rough stretch over the last 10 years. If you just step back and look at what we've had the decade begins with Bush v. Gore, followed quickly by the 19 men with box cutters overcoming the most expensive security apparatus in the history of human civilization to commit the worst act of mass murder in the country's history, followed by the largest corporate bankruptcy of all time in Enron, which now looks quaint because it's since been eclipsed by the wreckage of the financial crisis, and then the moral strategic disaster of Iraq and the human cost and financial cost. And that only gets us midway through the decade. I could keep going.
But they're not all connected, are they?
No, I mean, so I think there's two ways to look at it. There's been a kind of unhappy accident of confluence of contingent institutional failures. But I think when you zero in on some of the themes of elite failure, the failure of decision-making, judgment, and probity on the part of the elites who helm our pillar institutions, there are some very intensely apparent uniting themes.
And you're right that we're in the midst of a broad and devastating crisis of authority. Has nearly every institution in American life been discredited?
With some exceptions. The notable exception in the United States Armed Forces, which is the most trusted institution in American life, the only institution that has seen its esteem grow over the last decade. The police force are trusted, and everything else is poorly trusted. In fact, the polling that I looked at, it all starts around 1972 and 1973, and the reason it starts is because the country at that point is going through a very wrenching crisis of authority in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate, and they start asking folks, how much confidence do you have in this institution? The news media, newspapers, the presidency. And that period they thought was a nadir, but in fact, in retrospect, was a high watermark for institutional trust.
Some people trust a lot less now than they did in the 70s.
Yes.
When we were talking about rebellion in this country.
And
we had to deal with Watergate.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a James Reston quote from 1970 I quote in the book about the fact that all the authorities in our life are now distrusted and viewed with skepticism. And it was a very common conversation at the time. It's not as common now, even though I think that this broad-based disillusionment and lack of trust in our pillar institutions is in some senses the defining experience of public life at this period.
Well, I can see why in some cases we have gridlock in Washington, for example. But why are the media in such bad graces with the public?
I think there's a pretty strong argument to say that, taken as a whole, and I'm overgeneralizing here because obviously, the media is a massive category, right? So WNYC and the big three networks and cable news and small blogs, et cetera, are all in that category. But I think taken as a whole, the two biggest stories of the decade were Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction, which the media largely got wrong, and the housing bubble and the growth of the securitization machine on Wall Street that allowed it to grow and profited off it, which the media also largely missed.
But the public actually thinking in those terms when they say we have little regard for the media, we don't trust it?
I think that's part of it. I mean, I think, you know, you look around.
James Cramer's still out there.
What's that?
Some of the people who were responsible are still on the air.
Oh, sure. There's no accountability for the actual people who got it wrong. That's actually part of the problem. But I think, look, when you look at when you find yourself as the American public was mired in the cataclysm that was the Iraq essential civil war that was happening in 2005, let's say, when you look at that situation or you look at the wreckage of the financial crisis and the Great Recession, you can't help but feel had. And feeling had, you have the, you know, there's a Michael Massing essay he wrote for the New York Review of Books about all the mea culpas after the Iraq War called Now They Tell Us. Mm-hmm. And Now They Tell Us is a kind of, I think, a common lay experience of the media.
When you say we've lost trust in elites, who exactly are you talking about? First of all, elite has a slightly pejorative connotation, doesn't it? The word?
Yeah, the word, you know, it's a very contested word. It's probably...
Elitist is an insult.
Elitist is absolutely an insult, and that's partly because, quite rightly, we have, a nice affection for populism and democratic culture and a healthy distrust of folks at the top. That's part of the American character, I think rightly so. You know, the word elite is extremely contested and fought over. I think it's as fought over as any word in the American political vocabulary besides freedom, which is the most fought over word. And it's generally deployed by people on the right in the last 10, 20, 30 years. And conservatives have, I think, distorted the traditional meaning of the word in very specific ways in which their definition of elite is a variety of cultural affections or affectations, cultural signifiers, you know, parts of you that the preferences you have. You listen to NPR, for instance. You drive a Prius. You live in certain parts of the country. You know, traditionally, the definition of elite, and this holds true for writers on the right and writers on the left who are analyzing elites, had very little to do with what kind of music you liked or what your consumer preferences were. It had to do with how much power you had. It was a, you know, relatively small group of people with a disproportionate influence over a society's direction.
But it also had a lot to do with how you presented yourself, because both John Kerry and George W. Bush went to Harvard, but John Kerry was the one who was called an elitist, despite the fact that he had been a Vietnam War hero. And windsurfing became an elitist activity when people went after him.
Well, that the Kerry attacks are a perfect example of the way in which the right redefined elite in a very self-serving way, because obviously George W. Bush is as elite as it gets. I mean, he has this tremendous pedigree. He's got a former president and a senator in the direct line of his last name. He is extremely wealthy. You know, if he doesn't count as elite, no one does. But if you redefine elite to mean these cultural preferences, you know, the fact that he likes country music or goes to a megachurch means that he's not elite, and the fact that John Kerry windsurfs mean he is.
But we are seeing some change, although the word elite wasn't used. There were reports about what happened in the Hamptons over the weekend, and a woman insisted she was VIP. That's the same thing, isn't it?
Well, what's interesting about the way this election is playing out in terms of these cultural roles and these definitions of elitism is that it's very difficult to define Mitt Romney in a way that doesn't make him look elite, because he doesn't have any of the regional cultural affectations that George W. Bush did that allowed him to get away with redefining himself out of the elite. He is squarely a member of the elite and in some sense is a proud member of the elite, and he is being funded by fellow members of the elite in a very explicit way.
My guest is Chris Hayes, who has written a book called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. He is the host of a show that airs Saturday and Sunday from 8 to 10 Eastern on MSNBC. Well, we'd like to think of ourselves as outsiders, people politicians run as being outsiders. Individualism, anti-establishment, those are the kinds of things that we like to present ourselves as, despite the fact that America during its best period always seemed to be run by an elite.
Well, you know, we have a – I don't know if I agree that America during its best period was run by an elite.
Well,
I
mean, well FDR, sure. You know, Jack Kennedy, Republicans and Democrats, right, of that time, they were all part of a very different kind of sensibility.
Sure, there was a very different culture to the establishment and the kind of WASP Protestant Northeastern elite that used to run the country.
Should we be returning to that?
No, I'm not. There are some people. I mean, David Brooks has a column today about my book, and he kind of expresses a sort of nostalgia for that ethos. I think that ethos was dysfunctional, bankrupt, and morally defensible in all sorts of other ways. But they're different ways than the way that our current elite is bankrupt. One of the features of the current elite is the fact that I think I write in the book that we have an overclass of people convinced they are scrappy underdogs, that this ethos of constant competition, of striving, of vanquishing, of marching up the ladder creates a certain set of pathologies in the elites that we have that leads to a lot of the kind of corner cutting that you see when you look at, say, the LIBOR emails that are coming out right now.
But doesn't that go all the way back to the earliest days of the country? Ben Franklin represents that kind of thinking, doesn't he?
Yeah, there is a strain of what our current system is, which we call the meritocracy, that has very old roots. And I think part of the reason that meritocracy has become a kind of consensus idea, a social model in American life that is broadly shared across different ideologies and backgrounds, is precisely because it is a modern incarnation of a very old vision of what made America exceptional, which is, of course, social mobility.
But isn't a system based on merit a just system?
The funny thing about that word merit is that it does so much work. I mean, it's almost tautological or self-evident to say, well, people with the most merit should have the most important jobs. But merit actually, when you zoom in on it, proves to be a much, much, much trickier thing to define than you might otherwise think. The way that our modern system works is that it tends to narrow down very tightly that definition. Smartness, and it produces what I call in the book a cult of smartness, and hard work of a certain kind. There are lots of virtues or qualities that people you might want to have if they have important positions of decision making: temperance, prudence, judgment, wisdom, compassion, open-mindedness. I mean, you could go on and on. All of those virtues are shorn aside by the way that we narrowly define merit and the way that the institutions we've constructed select for it.
Well, now it all has to do with how much money we've earned, hasn't it?
That's a great point. I mean, the other thing that makes it ends up circular and tautological and self-justifying about this entire enterprise is that because merit is so difficult to define, how much money you make proves to be a readily quantifiable stand-in.
Where does the word meritocracy come from? Isn't it a fairly recent word?
Yeah, the origins of it are quite really funny. It's coined by a British left-wing social critic named Michael Young in the 1950s. He writes a book called The Rise of the Meritocracy. And the book is a very strange and kind of wonderful book. It's written as a history from the future, and after, you know, it's like 2038 or something like that, looking back at British history after World War II during the period of a construction of what he coins as the meritocracy. Basically says, look, we realize that democracy, genuine democracy, could be no more than an illusion. You don't want rule by the people but so much as you want rule by the cleverest people. And he describes a history of a system in which very intense intelligence testing in schools and productivity testing in firms allows there to be this funneling process that elevates those with the most merit into the highest positions. And as someone with a deep egalitarian commitment to a vision of social democracy, the book is written as a satire. It's in the vein of 1984, Brave New World. It's a dystopic vision. And he was bemused and horrified at the end of his life to find that it had been adopted as a model. In 2001, he writes an op-ed in The Guardian saying, I meant this as satire. I did not mean this to be a model of what we actually wanted. And this is at a time when New Labour, in the form of Tony Blair, is explicitly saying our program will be a meritocracy.
So he meant it as a satire and people found it attractive. This is almost like Gordon Gekko.
Yes,
becoming
greed
a hero.
Is good. That's right. And what's remarkable in the American context, the first line of Goldman Sachs' recruiting page on their website is, Goldman Sachs is a meritocracy. Meritocracy is a very explicitly dominant mode of thinking about Wall Street among people who work on Wall Street. And in the American political vocabulary, you know, the word bureaucratic always has negative connotations. It's always an insult. I mean, no one ever got home from their first day at a job and said, you know, I love the place. It's fantastic. Totally bureaucratic. We all understand what bureaucratic means. But you can imagine someone coming home from their first day at a new organization saying, it's a great place. It's a completely meritocratic place. So we have this intuitive sense that meritocracy is good and bureaucracy is bad. And part of the project of the book is complicating that notion, is drawing out some of the ways in which meritocracies have costs that we don't often recognize.
My guest is Christopher Hayes, who's an editor-at-large at The Nation and host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC and author of a new book called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. It's published by Crown. Stay with us for more. We are back with Christopher Hayes, who's editor-at-large at The Nation, host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, His new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, published by Crown. You went to Hunter High School, which was considered an elite school, a fellow at Harvard Center for Ethics, a host of your own television show on MSNBC. Do you see yourself as a product of the same meritocratic system that you're critiquing in this book?
Oh, yeah, without question. I mean, the reason that I spend a chapter in the book writing about Hunter is precisely because I'm produced by these institutions. And I think there's a strong tendency for people that rise through these institutions to come to think that the system that conferred outsized benefits on them clearly knew what it was doing.
Yeah, they're told that they are special, aren't they?
Yeah, and it cultivates this, you know, one of the things that happens is it cultivates in people that do rise through these institutions, write for themselves a story of overcoming. And it doesn't matter how implausible it is. I mean, I do it for myself all the time. I mean, I'm a working class kid from the outer borough of the Bronx. My dad was a community organizer. My mom was an educator. And, you know, I worked hard and now I host a TV show. The American dream, as it were. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that it just erases tons of privilege to do that. You know, the fact that I'm a straight white man in a society that confers lots of benefits on straight white men. The fact that I was just lucky to have just tremendous parents who are tremendously important.
But luck plays a major role in success on almost every level.
Right. But it's written
no matter
out.
How hard you work, luck is an important part. And yet, it's my sense that people who rise to the top always feel that it's because of their own brilliance.
That's exactly
they
right.
They fall in love with their own brilliance.
That's exactly right. Because you don't see luck, but you see your own effort. First of all. And second of all, because the story that we've constructed isn't about luck. I mean, you know, a firm can do well or poorly based on a whole bunch of contingent factors. And in fact, part of the genius of capitalism when it is working is that things succeed for reasons that no one really could have foreseen. There's lots of people with good ideas that don't work and lots of people with ideas that you wouldn't think are good but do happen to work. And to graft onto that a story about merit, about desert, which is what is necessarily implied by the meritocracy, is to create some profound moral subtext to people's sense of entitlement for what they earn. You see it played out when people talk about top marginal tax rates, for instance.
Well, why do you think there's a tendency among people who has been successful under the current system to pull up the ladder behind them after they have reached the top?
A, I think it's partly human nature. People try to, you know, you have a child who's not testing well. You want that child to get good educational opportunities. You find out if a college would be willing to accept a new science wing if they would take your child into their school. That's I think partly human nature, but it's also just the nature of the outsized amount of resources that folks up at the top have, that they can use those resources to pull up the ladder, to do precisely that, to extend these benefits to their kin or their social circle. And the point the book makes, the core argument, is that, you know, meritocracy, whatever its allure in the abstract, in real terms, in reality, the way that we have it now, leads to something that does not look very meritocratic at all. Actually, it leads to a lot of embedded and passed on privilege.
Well, social mobility in this country is currently lower than it is in the rest of the Western world and lower than it ever has been in this country.
Yeah, well, certainly lower than it's been in the post-war period. Social mobility is a really difficult thing to measure.
So does that mean we have some kind of royalty today?
We don't have royalty, but we do have a huge there's two facts about American life that sit very awkwardly next to each other. One is the fact that we have less social mobility than almost every other industrialized democracy, possibly with the exception of England. The other is that when you ask
people— Well, it has a locked-in class system
sure, right.
that is hard to break down completely.
Right. Although I think we think of Europe broadly having that. So I think it's surprising to look at those numbers and see that, you know, the Dutch, for instance, have more social mobility. When you ask people in different countries the same question, how possible is it to start out poor in your country and work your way to the top? Americans do better than any other country in what we think about our own social mobility, and worse almost than anyone in the actual fact of it. And the tension between those two creates this intense kind of neuroses, this sense of betrayal that manifests itself in people articulating it as the game is rigged. Because we can, at one level, hew to this vision of what American life should be. At the other level, we see everyday examples of elites allowed to rig the system on their behalf. And so it can be very frustrating to try to bring those two together into understanding the reality of what American life looks like.
You write about attending the Davos conference in Switzerland, which you call fractal inequality in its purest form. What do you mean by fractal inequality?
So fractals are these nifty shapes that are rendered by computer formulas that exhibit what's called cell similarity. So if you zoom, every time you zoom in on them, they look like the larger image at large. And you keep zooming in. And that's a good way of describing the way that income is distributed currently in our system. We talk about, say, the 99% and the 1%. But if you zoom in to the 1%, just look at the 1% and the distribution there, it looks a lot like the broader distribution, which is that the 1/10 of 1% is doing much, much, much better than the other folks in the 1%, and on and on and on and on. And what this means is that everyone views themselves, wherever they are, particularly those in the elite, in the 1%, in the distribution, as relatively worse off than the folks right above them, because they can see those other folks just a rung above them on the ladder.
You note feeling a little self-satisfaction at getting to attend that World Economic Forum in 2011, then realizing that, I'm quoting, in the context of Davos attendees, you're a member of the unwashed masses.
Yeah, there's this funny experience where you get off the plane and you're thinking, wow, look at me. I'm going to Davos and this will be interesting. And then you get steered towards a bus that's going to take you to the ski town. And as you're going to the bus, then you sort of recognize that there's these folks that are getting off the plane in first class who are being chauffeured around by a bunch of red-coated, attractive young Swiss employees of Davos who are spiriting them into gleaming black Mercedes S-classes to be driven to the ski town. You realize, oh, we're actually just the we're in the low level of this. And then those folks who get there through the sedan, they're going to go to some cocktail party and recognize that the true ballers actually fly a helicopter over the Alps to get from the airport to Davos.
Well, that was in 2011. The global economy was already coming apart at the seams. Did you have a sense that the people who had created today's economic order were feeling chastened at all?
I had one really, really interesting conversation very late at night after several rounds with a European economist who had worked and consulted for many of the major American banks, Goldman Sachs particularly, who said, in retrospect, we were all blind. We were all of us were wrong. Larry Summers, Bob Rubin, myself. The emperor had no clothes and we didn't see it. But that was definitely the exception rather than the rule.
Because you write, all the smart people screwed up and no one seems willing to take responsibility.
Yeah.
I've cleaned up your language a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, yeah, I was about to say. Paraphrasing. That, to me, was what made the experience of Davos so strange, which was that, you know, here are the people who oversaw the crisis. And there was very little soul-searching. There was very little sense of culpability or accountability. And I think you see that today. I mean, if you read interviews with Jamie Dimon, you know, he says, what do you want from me? You know, we steered our ship pretty well, and we're going to be back to profitability and helping American capitalism work.
And he's gotten off pretty easy, hasn't he? I mean, he's gotten off easy. The media has not been all that hard on him. Congress was almost, in some cases, loving toward him. Why is it that the people in the media who are closest to the establishment seem to be the most blindsided when things turn out to be wrong? Shouldn't they be getting more inside information than the rest of us?
Yeah, that has not generally proven to be the case. With some really notable examples. I mean, there's great reporting on Wall Street. Matt Taibbi, who's been writing amazing stuff at Rolling Stone, and
but he's kind of an outsider.
Yeah, right. But I think this insider-outsider distinction starts to get blurry. But there's a certain mentality, and it's a mentality you see, I think, in Washington particularly, where I was a reporter for a few years, where the people who are reporting and the people they're reporting on have more in common than the people who are reporting and their readers.
So you also, when your friend tells you that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and somebody else tells you it's not true, you just discount the other person because that person isn't in the know.
Right. That's exactly right. There is a tendency to trust the people that occupy the same social circle as you. And in a town like Washington particularly, that social circle is comprised of reporters and principals.
My guest is Christopher Hayes, who's written a book called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, published by Crown. You can see him on weekends as a host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. He's also an editor-at-large at The Nation. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many financial firms came out of the 2008 crisis doing well. In fact, J.P. Morgan Chase, I think, just announced that it is profitable this year, despite the latest announcement that they lost $5.8 billion, and it could be higher in this this most recent embarrassing debacle. So, what's the incentive for them not continuing the same practices that sank the economy in the first place?
I don't think there is much incentive. I think, there's this idea of economists have of moral hazard, moral hazard being conditions under which you are separated from accountability for your actions. And they've typically used it to describe the way certain insurance markets work.
But the moral hazard was applied a lot more to the people who took out faulty mortgages. They should have known better than to the institutions that were creating those mortgages.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, traditionally, we should be very clear here when you're talking about the buildup of the bubble and subprime and so forth. The responsibility for making credit judgments lies with the creditor, not the debtor. It's with the lender, not the borrower. That is the way financial capitalism works. There's a judgment that's made by the institution making the lending. When all of it blows up and it comes time to assess and assign culpability, it seems perverse and bizarre and ahistorical to begin handing that out to the borrowers when that wasn't ever the traditional role or the institutional role that borrowers played.
We have more access to information than any other time in human history. Why hasn't that led to a more informed and engaged society?
In some ways, I think we are more informed, but I think that information is so unevenly distributed. I mean, what is so bewildering about navigating public life and citizenship in this moment is the combination of these two trends. And this was in some ways the place in which the book started for me, just as my own experiences. At one level, you have this crisis of authority, this bankrupting of trust in our pillar institutions, no real place that we all come and sit at the same table. And that's exacerbated by this fracturing of audiences. I mean, Walter Cronkite had 20 million viewers every night. That's more than all the three major networks, even newscasts, now get combined, right? So there's just an actual fracturing happening. At the same time, there's this unbelievable proliferation of new sources of authority, of new people to listen to. And it's thrilling at a certain level, particularly if you work all day in this field and you get to read all sorts of new perspectives and new ideas and think tank reports and academic papers. But it also is bewildering. I mean, the having to adjudicate all these disputes relies so heavily on a level amount of time that people, A, don't have because they're working very hard, and B, a whole set of trust relationships that have been broken by the experience of the decade.
And that's the reason that Congress currently has a lower approval rating than Paris Hilton.
And the U.S. going communist.
You say the defenders of the status quo use neo-Calvinist logic. What do you mean by that?
It gets back to what we were describing earlier, which is that the idea that those at the top are there because they are the elect, because they have something special, distinct, chosen about them, rather than they are the products largely of some kinds of privilege or happenstance or luck, all of which can go together. People can be smart and hardworking and also in the right place at the right time.
But we also believe that our system has always had the ability to self-correct in times of crisis. Are we deluded?
I don't think we're deluded. I just think we're in a strange, awkward, frustrating interregnum right now.
So that's not happening right now?
I don't think it is. I think that largely the institutional landscape remains pretty unaltered. We haven't seen deep reform. The financial regulatory reform that was passed was – there's a few good aspects of it. But it didn't dramatically change the way Wall Street relates to Washington. And that in some ways is the crucial first step in all of this.
In 10 seconds, your subtitle is America After Meritocracy. What will replace it?
A more equal society. A. B. I'm very curious to hear what people think America after meritocracy looks like.
Christopher Hayes' book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, is published by Crown. You can also see him on MSNBC on weekends on his show, Up with Chris Hayes. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
It was really a pleasure.